This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM, KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. On today's show, first Paul Johnson, state lobbyist for the Kansas Rural Center, discusses toxic spraying of noxious weeds in Kansas and the meeting planned this week to address that issue. Next, Pat Elder, a teacher and political activist on issues including toxins in our water systems, was in town on February 21st to kick off his tour of military bases contaminated with per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, P-F-A-S. Craig Lubo had a chance to interview him. But first, the environmental news for the week of March 25th, 2019. My name's Mike Murphy. Democracy Now! Reports that residents of Deer Park outside Houston, Texas, were ordered to shelter in place last week because of dangerous levels of toxic benzene kicked up by a massive fire at a petrochemical plant. Schools were closed, and residents were advised to limit outside exposure. The plant is run by Intercontinental Terminals Company, which has been sued for illegally dumping more than 1 million gallons of hazardous waste into the floodwaters during Hurricane Harvey in 2017 so they could save money. A San Francisco jury found that Monsanto's Roundup herbicide was a substantial factor in the cancer of California resident Edwin Hardiman, who said he sprayed the widely used herbicide on his property for almost 3 decades and once got the product directly on his skin. In August last year, a state jury found Monsanto's Roundup was responsible for the cancer of a former school groundskeeper. A new analysis by the Environmental Working Group finds 70% of fresh produce sold across the United States is contaminated with pesticide. Topping the list of contaminated produce are strawberries and spinach, while more than 9 out of 10 samples of kale were found to contain residues of pesticides. Authorities have declared states of emergency in Missouri, Nebraska, and Iowa for communities along the Missouri River because melting snow and rainstorms have caused the river to breach levees and overflow its banks. The floods have killed 4 people over the past week and caused an estimated $1 billion in damage. The I-29 closure at the Missouri-Iowa border has been extended further south to U.S. Highway 71 intersection north of St. Joseph due to the flooding. KC Water is asking customers to conserve water following news that the utility was having treatment challenges as a result of flooding from the Missouri River. Tests confirmed there was no biologic or virus contamination, but the utility said on Sunday the high turbidity alert issued on Friday remains in effect. And a federal court has temporarily blocked oil and gas drilling on 300,000 acres of federal land in Wyoming, saying the Interior Department failed to take the impact of climate change into consideration when issuing leases. And that's the news for this evening. My name is Mike Murphy, and joining me on the phone is Mr. Paul Johnson. Paul is a policy analyst with the Kansas Rural Center. And welcome to Eco Radio KC, Paul.
Thanks, Mark.
So, first off, tell us about the Kansas Rural Center. What does that do?
Well, it's been around since 1979, and it works on independent family farm issues, and it works on local and regional food systems, and we work on water and environmental issues.
Okay. But we're here to talk tonight about toxic spraying that goes on. Am I overstating it? Or?
Different people have different definitions, but specifically for tonight, we're talking about noxious weeds. and who regulates them, and what, you know, what authority do counties have at it, and, you know, we need a broader community discussion about the expansion of certain herbicides in our state.
So there's going to be a meeting on this very subject on Wednesday night at 6:30 at the Jefferson County Courthouse in the second floor courtroom in Oskaloosa, Kansas. That's 300 West Jefferson Street.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go into that a little bit more a little later. But
all right.
So, what's a noxious weed?
Well, up until a year ago, our Kansas law changed dramatically, and I can talk about that. But
well, please.
Noxious weeds were defined by our Kansas legislature, and about half the states do it that way. And they passed legislation and declared various weeds noxious, and then the state set parameters for controlling these weeds, and it's the actual counties, 105 in county in Kansas, that actually implement the control of these noxious weeds. So in Kansas, we have 12 of them on our list right now, from bindweed to musk thistle to Johnson grass, and our latest one that was put in 15 years ago was Ceriza lespidiza. And so those are then considered villains in our state, and counties have, you know, broader control for using herbicides or control methods.
So what is it about these that makes them so villainous? Are they intrusive?
Well, I'm not sure that we have a very good definition even today of really what set the template for, you know, why these are more noxious than some other invasive species. Some of it's the amount of acreage that they impact across Kansas. And so it's, you know, it's been somewhat nebulous, and I'm not sure we're getting any better on defining it.
So when, like, say, for example, where, you know, this happens all around Kansas, but we're talking about Jefferson County, and
uh-huh.
Jefferson County is just north of Douglas County, is that right?
Yes, between Douglas and Shawnee, which is where Topeka sits, and, okay. You know, it's, 18,000 people, and, you know, primarily agriculture at this point, although we have a number of more special crop growers and organic growers and, you know, some wineries in our county. And so, you know, Jefferson County is trying to respond to kind of a local food interest.
So what roadside spraying of noxious weeds, is the concern of what they're doing to the road, is the concern that they'll spread, you know, if we nip it in the bud here at the road, it won't spread. What would happen if we didn't spray
them? That's part of it. I meant, we have thousands of miles of dirt and, you know, paved road in Jefferson County. And so our county weed department is controlling in the right-of-ways and the ditches and that. And they use a number of various chemicals of, you know, 2,4-D being one of the primary ones. And, you know, a lot of, you know, this community meeting is about asking questions about whether there's any drift problems with this spraying, and are there days that from wind or heat or humidity that they shouldn't be spraying them in. We're just trying to have a dialogue in our county that, you know, we understand that they're crop sprayers, and we're just trying to have an understanding of what people can do to protect their own land.
Do you know? So it's the Public Works Department of Jefferson County or any given county in Kansas. And
right.
So do the employees that drive these spray trucks, do they have to have some kind of special certification And do they have to wear some kind of special protective gear? Do you know about that?
I'm not sure I know all the answers to those questions. I do not think they need special registration as far as being an employee of our noxious weed department. And they assure me that they are doing it in a very low-pressure way, that they're really concentrating on very small patches of right-of-way, and they're pretty confident that their chemicals stay put better than the aerial spraying that you see for crops and brome grassland across our county.
So is the spray coming from trucks as they're moving, or are people getting out of the... Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. As opposed to aerial application from broader crop aerial sprayers.
Okay. Okay. And so tell us about some of the... What are the concerns about some of the things that are used to deter these noxious weeds?
Well, it's... You know, the chemical companies have had, you know, farmers on a treadmill for quite a while. And 1996 was really the first commercial introduction of Roundup, which is primary chemical is glyphosate. And that's the broadest used herbicide in our country. And what's happened over the last 25 years is... You know, Mother Nature bats last, and it has evolved. And so I think in Kansas we're up to 12 or 15 weeds that are now glyphosate-resistant, Roundup-ready resistant.
Wow.
So now we're taking the next step. We're reintroducing back, you know, some older herbicides like 2,4-D and dicamba particularly that are much more volatile. You know, they have much more drift problems. And, I mean, in Kansas, we don't define drift in any of our laws. You know, if you're chemically trespassed by a neighbor farmer or a neighbor crop sprayer, it's up to you to understand the damage, report it in time, and good luck in the court system trying to get some recovery.
Yeah, I bet. So are there any, is there any thought or do they have any policy with regard to proximity to streams or creeks or anything like that when they spray?
Well, you know, you hope so. We kind of divide it. If you're a commercial crop sprayer, you are somewhat regulated and you're buying some amount of insurance for protection against damages. If you're Farmer Jones and you've got that 1,000-acre farm and you're spraying yours and maybe your neighbors, you know, the only thing our state law says is follow the instructions on the bag.
Wow.
And, you know, if they say don't spray if it's, you know, over 10 miles an hour wind or if it's so hot, I don't, you know, to think that that's very regulated is probably wishful thinking.
Okay, and so, like, let's talk a little bit about this meeting that's planned for Wednesday night. Okay, so the county's weed department is going to be there. The county actually has a weed department.
Yes, wow. All counties have weed departments in the state of Kansas.
Interesting.
Yeah, and, well, I approached... you know, I'm a policy analyst, lobbyist for the Rural Center. We've been working on noxious weed regulation for 2 or 3 years at the state legislature in Topeka and finally lost the battle for change, and we can go into that. But so I approached one of our three county commissioners and said, I think we ought to have a community discussion about our operations of our noxious weed department in Jefferson County. And what do we know about commercial sprayers? And eventually, what's going to happen with new rules and regulations for this state law that's coming in the next few months?
Okay. And so Are the county commissioners expected to be at this meeting?
Well, the county commissioners is going to moderate it.
Okay.
And it was, you know, that's why I went to her to ask, you know, she's, Jefferson County would love to promote even more specialty crops, more, you know, market gardens, more grape growing. You know, we feel like that could be a niche for our county, but if we're going to do that, then we need some protections in place to help against drift and inadvertent spray damage.
Do you have any sense of, like, you know, like how much of the agriculture in Jefferson County is organic?
I don't think I have a good handle on that. It's still organic production overall is, 5% nationwide. So, it might be a little higher in Jefferson County, but, the interest in local food, the interest in, how your food's produced, the restaurants who are highlighting more local food options, more farmers markets. I mean, it's an evolving paradigm.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, again, this meeting is on
Wednesday night. It starts at 6:30 in the courthouse in Oskaloosa on the second floor. And we're going to have our public works director, who's over the noxious weed department, talk about what their present practices are and, how people can post their land if they want to be a no-spray zone. And, what other options we have to give people an idea of protecting from chemical drift.
Do you need some kind of rationale for, can you just say I want to be a no-spray zone, or do you have to say my livelihood depends on it? Or
no, I think you basically can go to our Noxious Weed Department Public Works and request signage that you post, on your land. Obviously, in the satellite world that we're living in, our state Department of Agriculture has what's called a Drift Watch website that you can post your land on that, and that probably really, is appropriate or tells commercial crop sprayers that there's certain land that they need to take special notice of.
Okay. All right. Well, is there anything else we haven't touched on?
Well, the state law, I won't dwell too much on it, but up until last year, the legislature used to select which weeds were on noxious weeds. We've now decided to take it away from the legislative branch, and we're going to give it to the executive branch. And in Kansas, that will be the Kansas Department of Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So we're setting up our Secretary of Agriculture as the weed czar. And we've worked on, in the legislation, getting an advisory committee that has some organic farmers and different people on it that hopefully will balance the discussion. But this weed czar is going to have much broader latitude to start picking out weeds. And like I said earlier, we've already run through 12 or 15 plants that now are glyphosate resistant.
Wow.
I think we need a broader discussion for the community and the state as to, where the safety and of our food is going.
Okay. And if people want to participate in this local discussion, that takes place on Wednesday night.
Come to the courthouse on Wednesday night. If you're in Topeka or Lawrence or wherever in Jefferson County, and going forward, the KansasRuralCenter.org, which is our website, is going to post notices or information on, as the State Department of Agriculture writes the rules and regs for this new state law, we're going to keep people informed of that and see where they can interact in making that as fair and balanced as possible.
All right. Well, Paul Johnson of the Kansas Rural Center, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and good luck with moving forward with this. Appreciate what you do.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
All right. Have a good night.
Bye.
Take care.
Okay, this is Craig Lubow, and thank you for joining us here on Eco Radio. With me today, I have Pat Elder. Pat is a political activist and writer, and he writes for civilianexposure.org. Welcome, Pat.
Well, thanks, Craig. Thanks a great deal for having me.
So we're going to talk about the Richard Gebauer, and that's an old Air Force base. Is that correct?
Right. That is severely contaminated base that's been closed for quite some time now. That's local, but I'll also address the entire issue of PFAS contamination.
PFAS?
PFAS, that's right. These are.
And what does that stand for?
Well, it stands for poly and perfluoroalkyl compounds. And there are over 3,000 of them. And the two most notorious are PFOS and PFOA. And they're used in firefighting foams on military bases. And in a nutshell, to prepare airmen and soldiers for extinguishing fire blazes, the military will routinely light massive fires with jet fuel and contaminated jet fuel, and then train the soldiers to extinguish the flames with this cancer-causing foam, which is then allowed to leach into the soil and contaminate adjacent communities and their well water.
All right. And so when they're using these chemicals, they're not, like, capturing them. They're just letting them go as runoff.
Well, not always. Sometimes they are captured by municipal sewer systems. So I'll give you an example. Outside of Spangledem Air Base, for instance, in Germany, the PFAS foams that they spray wind up in the municipal water system, in the sewer system. And, you know, typically it's something people don't understand or think a great deal about. But when sewer sludge is collected, it is routinely put into giant trucks and brought to rural areas and, you know, slathered onto fields. But in Wittlichland, which is a small German community adjacent to Spangledem, they have been told by the German federal government that they're not allowed to slather the poisonous compounds on the fields because it was, you know, had the potential to poison wildlife and birds and all kinds of animals, molecular animals in the soil. So they were forced to incinerate it, which is a god-awful way to get rid of PFAS. And there's been quite a bit of research done, particularly by Sharon Lerner, who is a reporter with The Intercept, who has now written 20 articles on the issue. She reports that incineration is just a god-awful way to go because they're not actually destroying all of these chemicals. But I should take a moment to explain just how horrendous this stuff is. And you can get an idea from a series of articles written by Tara Kopp, C-O-P-P. Tara writes for Military Times, which is a Gannett publication. Gannett, of course, owns USA Today. And, boy, she has a series of articles. Her first was called Why Women Were Told Not to Get Pregnant at George Air Force Base. Which rocked my world. She documented cases where women drank the water and had miscarriages and developed uterine cancer, and many had hysterectomies. And long story short, as far as Tara Kopp and her reporting is concerned, a couple of the women from George Air Base put together a Facebook group And they said, I was at George Air Base, and I had a miscarriage. And then someone else and someone else. And before you know it, you have 300 women coming forward saying, we've had miscarriages or other types of, female-related complications. Pretty darn horrendous stuff. And as Tara Kopp got into it, she asked for their medical records, and they were all expunged. So she's identified half a dozen women who produced redacted medical records regarding the cause of their female reproductive problems. The PFAS contamination outside of George Air Base today is still in the thousands and thousands of parts per trillion. It is still lethal, and that's because these chemicals don't break down. And they're also known to cause testicular cancer, micropenis, liver cancer, kidney cancer, and just other problems regarding human health. And it's something people don't know much about. And the horrible part about it is that, the stuff is continued to be used by the military.
And the chemicals you're referring to at that Air Force base, those are the same chemicals that are being used at Richards Gebauer.
Well, Richards Gebauer is, of course, closed, that is correct. They're the two worst. These are eight carbon atoms that are fused with fluoride atoms. And so they make the most dangerous PFAS types of compounds that we know. And they were used extensively from the 50s until just 2 to 3 years ago by all the military branches. And they have since replaced these so-called legacy foams. They're called AFFF. These are aqueous film-forming foams. It's a mouthful. They have replaced these eight atom chain compounds with six atom chain compounds. The stuff is still extremely lethal, as Sharon Lerner with The Intercept has reported in the last 2 months or so. So they are still widely spread. And in fact, some new research shows that as they travel through the groundwater, they may even be more dangerous because the plumes travel quicker. So we just don't know because there hasn't been a great deal of publicity. The military did report on 141 bases in March of 18. And they listed the contamination in the groundwater in the bases and adjacent communities. In some bases, as I mentioned, England Air Force Base outside of Alexandria, Egypt, is at 10.9 million parts per trillion in their groundwater. And so, it's a problem. The military sent out notices to people in adjacent communities. And basically saying, we'd like to test your water. They did so across the country. Problem is, a lot of these places weren't tested far enough out. Environmentalists feel that the plumes could have extended much further. Also, there was a flurry of press information in individual communities. I'll give you an example. Chesapeake Beach, Maryland, at the Naval Observatory Post on the Chesapeake Bay there, reported the PFAS in the groundwater of 241,000 parts per trillion. And a notice went out that was actually in the Baynet newspaper, the small town paper. This is east of Washington, about 30 miles. But then it disappeared. Well, there's no other mention in the media. You'd think, gosh, no letters to the editor, nothing in the chat rooms. No. And so I've been able to identify at least a dozen places across the country where an initial press release went out that said, hey, the Air Force is going to test your water. We think it's poisonous. And then there's no follow-up. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And so that's my intention, just to put out what I've been able to discover, which is simply repackaging what several groups. I've already mentioned Tara Kopp with Military Times. I mentioned Sharon Lerner with The Intercept. I'd also like to mention the Environmental Working Group. It is working out of Northeastern University in Boston, and they have done stellar work as well, including publishing a database of all of the military bases and the levels of contamination for PFAS.
Earlier you mentioned that the medical records of these women had been expunged. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, it would say Sarah Tompkins, George Air Force Base, 4 months pregnant, miscarriage taking place as a result of, and then four lines of dark black ink.
Okay.
And so we had that with several different women. I'd like to go back and talk a little bit about Wittlich Land. I didn't quite finish that. But in Germany, you know, the Spangledem, of course, is an American NATO air base. And the you know, they continue to practice with these cancerous foams, which then go into the sewer system, which the town is then forced to incinerate at a cost. And so for years, the German government was reimbursing the town for incinerating the cancer-causing sludge, and stopped doing so last year. And so the town wanted to sue the United States military. But because of the SOFA, which is your military agreement, your status of forces agreement between the German government and the American government, they were precluded from doing so. So the town of Wittlich Land is suing the German government instead. And I think that this is a court case with monumental implications internationally. I've written about it on the Civilian Exposure website. It's not really being picked up by anyone anywhere. And I can only guess who's going to win that court case, you know, Craig?
Okay. You've been talking about the chemicals at the military bases. In terms of civilian airports, do they not use the same chemicals, or do they have something different?
Nope, they use the same chemicals. In fact, they were required to do so until just last year, where you know, the FAA made a ruling that said they're absolved from being required to use PFAS and can use substitute formulas in order to put out fires. And that's part of the problem with the military, because the military has a regulation that dates back to the 1970s that mandates these foams be made of these PFAS ingredients that merge the, you know, carbon and the fluorides. They are the most amazing chemicals ever, in a way, made by human beings. They're the same ingredients that go into making Teflon. In 1939, a 3M scientist, apparently in Minnesota, stumbled into it by accident. Overnight, he mixed these atoms of fluorides and carbons and came across a substance that was harder than anything, a substance that repelled fire and oil and water better than anything. I mean, it is stuff of legendary proportions. You know, it's like really, the Greek epics and the Greek stories of Prometheus, and he stole fire from the gods and brought it to the earth, and so now you have this fire being quelled in a way that is poisoning humanity.
So, of the substitute chemicals that are out there, are some of them equally effective but safer?
No, short answer. I think nothing is better than the 8-atom carbon chain PFAS, like the PFOS and the PFOA. However, I think we need to weigh the importance here. I think tests have been done that say that flames may take more than a few seconds longer to extinguish with the the less powerful sprays. So certainly it's something that it made sense when the military switched to PFAS light, but still. The stuff needs to be discontinued, and the military must be forced to clean up the mess that it's made, and to take care of people that and land and crops that it's poisoned. I mean, just to give you an illustration of how bad this stuff is, Wurtsmith Air Base in Michigan closed down 25 years ago. And it was heavily contaminated with this spray. And so streams several miles away today are still contaminated with the stuff. And the deer drink, of course, from the streams, and they've been judged to be poisonous. Mm-hmm. And so you can't eat the deer meat 25 years after the base has been closed.
And what is the EPA doing about this? And who has the final regulatory authority over it on the military basis? Is it the Pentagon or the EPA?
Well, they're one and the same, aren't they, Craig? that's the question of the day, and it's a loaded question. You know, the EPA ruled just last week that they are not going to regulate the PFAS. Now, they have what we call MCLs or maximum contaminant levels on things like mercury, which means that the EPA says, okay, your MCL on this contaminant is such and such of, parts per trillion. And, hey, municipal water system, you can't pollute the water. If the water has so much more than this MCL, then you subject yourself to litigation and you subject yourself to being required by the EPA and its regulations and your state probably, if it's on the ball, to clean up the mess and to clean up the water. Those are mandatory limits. There's no mandatory limit for PFAS exposure. Instead, what the EPA has done is it has issued an advisory. And the advisory is a lifetime health advisory of 70 parts per trillion. Now, the Harvard scientists, Philip Grandjean in particular, Harvard Health, estimates that one part per trillion is damaging to human health, that exposure to PFAS. So while the EPA basically drops back and refuses to regulate the PFAS, that gives the military free rein to be able to continue to use the stuff. But perhaps more importantly, there are many who estimate the costs of potential litigation for health and environmental destruction exceeds hundreds of billions of dollars and might even get into the trillions. We're not just talking about the United States either. We're talking about contamination in Guam. We're talking about contamination in Okinawa and in Germany. I mean, even Belgium. We have bases in Belgium that have been ordered to drink, bottled water, and villages in Belgium that can only drink bottled water because of the fear of cancer from the runoff of PFAS from the military bases.
Do any of those foreign countries have any regulatory authority over the chemicals that our military uses over there?
No.
And just for those who have joined us after we started, since we've talked about the PFAS a lot, if you'll tell them again what those letters stand for.
They are per- and polyalkaloids compounds, and they are the result of merging carbon and fluoride atoms to create a substance that is excellent at extinguishing fires. And it is made into a foam. Typically, it's mixed with water at from 3 to 6%. And when it is sprayed by firefighters, it actually creates what looks like soap bubbles. And the soap bubbles are then coated over the airplanes and on the runway, which is several inches thick. Another practice of the military is to take giant 2- and 3-foot cylinder massive spray systems, and some of these hangars where the aircraft are parked might have dozens of these foam sprayers at the top of the hangar, and they'll have occasional tests where they'll flood a 2-acre hangar with a 1/2 foot of the foam spray, and sometimes 2 and 3 feet of the foam spray, and then just spray it out into, let it leach into the groundwater.
All right. And how bad is it at Richards Gebauer compared to the other bases you mentioned in across the country?
Richards Gebauer is severely contaminated. The old burn pit now has PFAS contamination at about 340,000 parts per trillion. We're talking about an area that's at the intersection of Scott Road and Route 150. It's actually about 2,000 feet to the west of Scott and 150. And that's where they, for years, would make a giant crater, and they would fill the crater with 400 or 500 gallons of contaminated fuel oil, and then light it on fire, and then have firefighters put it out. And they did that routinely for a generation.
Okay. And what is being done to clean this up, if anything, at Richards Gebauer specifically? And is it, are any of these bases declared to be Superfund sites?
Well, nothing is being done at Richards Gebauer. And Richards Gebauer is a Superfund site. So we have a lengthy list of contaminants at Richards Gebauer. You can go to an excellent website by ProPublica. I got to love ProPublica. And it's called Bombs in Your Backyard. And if you go to Bombs in Your Backyard, and you can click on Missouri, and then you can click on Richards Gebauer, and you can see all of the contaminants there. But because the PFAS that I'm addressing is not regulated by the EPA, it is not part of the Superfund sites listings. And so you won't see it on sites like, ProPublica's Bombs in Your Backyard.
Okay.
So we don't know, and we don't know if there's been any testing done of community wells, and we don't know if there have been any letters sent to anybody in the community. That is something your listeners may want to think about. If you know anybody who lives within a couple miles, and I believe the groundwater runs out in a top left direction. So that would be northwesterly direction of Scott Road and 150. And so if you're – and that is where the your new banister base is. So beyond that and to the north and west of that, if you have a private well, you may want to get it tested.
All right. So that's about all the time we have. I want to thank you for being with us. For those who just joined us, I've been talking with Pat Elder. He's a political activist and a writer for CivilianExposure.org. And that last site that you said we can go to for more information, what was that site again?
Well, there are several of them. Environmental Working Group, Northeastern University. Simply Google Environmental Working Group. And they have a listing of all of the levels of contamination for PFAS at military bases across the country. And the other one for your you know, your basic beryllium and uranium and these types of things at bases is ProPublica's Bombs in Your Backyard.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You betcha, buddy.
Now the calendar of events for the week of March 25th, 2019. The Native Plants Wild Edible Plant Identification and Hike will be held from 1 to 3 on Tuesday, March 26th at Burrow Oak Woods Conservation Center, 1401 Northwest Park Road in Blue Springs. Registration is required at the Missouri Department of Conservation. Also on March 26th at 8 p.m., Vegetable Garden Basics Workshop is helpful for beginning and experienced gardeners. This takes place at the Kansas City Community Gardens at 6917 Kensington. More info at kccg.org. On March 27th, on Wednesday, meeting on toxic sprays and noxious weeds in Jefferson County, Kansas. Again, Wednesday at 6:30 p.m., Jefferson County Courthouse, second floor courtroom, 300 West Jefferson Street in Oskaloosa. More info available at cedarelf@yahoo.com. Also on Wednesday, the Green New Deal in Kansas and Missouri will be at Californo's, 4124 Pennsylvania Avenue in Kansas City. Winston Apple and Jim Turner will lead the discussion from 6 to 8 p.m., hosted by Green Drinks and the Heartland Renewable Energy Society. More info at info@heartlandrenewable.org. Saturday, March 30th from 3:30 to 5:30 p.m., Reversing Global Warming, Kansas City Intro to Drawdown will be held in the Kansas City, Missouri, Westport area. Email kcdrawdown@gmail.com to find out more info about that. Also on that same day, Saturday from 9 to 1, the Municipal Farm Community Workday takes place at 4635 East Coal Mine Road in Kansas City, hosted by the Heartland Conservation Alliance. More info available on their Facebook page. Also on Saturday, Planting for Backyard Birds Workshop, March 30th from 4 to 5:30 p.m. at Greenworks of Kansas City, at 607 East 31st Street in Kansas City, Missouri. More info or to register, go to Greenworks on Facebook. Earth Hour, also on March 30th from 8:30 to 9:30 p.m. Saturday night, millions of people around the world will be turning off their lights for Earth Hour, a World Wildlife Fund action of solidarity in the fight against climate change. For more info, visit Earth Hour on Facebook. And on Sunday, March 31st, Wyandotte County Lake Conditioning Hike, March 31st from 8:30 to 1:45, organized by the Kanza Group of the Sierra Club. They'll meet at Wyandotte County Park Shelter House 2, Shelter House 2 Access Road in Kansas City, Kansas. You can contact Matt at 913-484-2212 or email zionhikes@yahoo.com. And there will be a screening of the video of Marcus Borg's presentation entitled For God So Loved the World, Shepherding Life on Earth on Monday, April 1st from 7 to 8:30 at Village Presbyterian Church, 6641 Mission Road in Prairie Village, Kansas. More info at 816-866-5715 or at sskc.org. These items and more can be found at kkfi.org on the Eco Radio KC page or on the Eco Radio KC Facebook page.
A car powered by seawater? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Flooding last week in the Midwest took three lives and could cost billions of dollars in lost homes, crops, livestock, and even permanent loss of topsoil.
Heavy rains came during the recent bomb cyclone that dumped water on frozen ground, unable to absorb it. Earther reports that runoff in some areas of Iowa, Nebraska, and Missouri swept away productive topsoil needed to grow wheat, soybean, and corn, and replaced it with sand and silt.
The floods have also shut down nearly 15% of the country's ethanol production due to rail lines being washed out and corn storage being flooded.
Military bases have been affected. 80 buildings at the Offutt Air Force Base, home of the U.S. Strategic Air Command, were swamped. The Associated Press noted that flooding is an example of how weather extremes are not limited to the coasts and a dramatic example of how climate change poses a national security threat.
Flooding could persist for months due to snow melting in the northern states, according to NOAA, with two-thirds of the country at risk.
Last week, a judge temporarily blocked oil and gas drilling on thousands of acres in Wyoming because the federal government had failed to consider climate change.
The judge ruled that the government must focus not just on how drilling might affect plants, animals, and water near a site, but also on the consequences of burning the fuel once it's extracted. The case could have implications for drilling on all public lands.
Extracting and burning fossil fuels from federal lands generates emissions that equal almost 1.5 billion tons of carbon dioxide annually, which is about a quarter of all the emissions of CO2 in the U.S.
The New York Times reports that the suit in which the judge issued his order was filed against the Obama administration before the 2016 election, but the ruling could put a dent in the Trump administration's plans to expand drilling on public lands, including offshore.
There are two new studies about climate change. The first is from the USGS and shows that rising sea levels threaten California's economy 10 times more than extreme wildfires or earthquakes.
The report published in the journal Nature says that higher oceans mean storms could cause $150 billion in damage to coastline structures and put as many as 600,000 people at risk from flooding by the end of the century. But even in the next 20 years, much property will be vulnerable.
The second study is about CO2 emissions from high elevations of the Rocky Mountains. We've already known that permafrost melting in the Arctic can release greenhouse gases that have been trapped for centuries. But the new research suggests that snowy mountain ecosystems around the world also contain permafrost that may be in jeopardy as the climate warms.
The study from the University of Colorado and published in the journal Nature Communications finds that landscapes above 11,000 feet in the Colorado Rockies are leaking CO2 into the atmosphere more than they are capturing, and the leaked carbon was relatively old.
In summer, carbon is being absorbed by plants, but the study shows that greenhouse gases are being released during the colder months.
John Knowles, the lead author, told E&E News that something is happening to release carbon that had been stored for decades or even centuries, and research may suggest that the area had intact permafrost, but recent warming and environment change has caused the soil to degrade.
Electric vehicles are viewed as a good choice to reduce CO2 emissions, but there's another potential option for clean transportation: fuel cell vehicles, which use hydrogen mixed with oxygen to power an electric motor. The only byproduct is water.
However, there are several obstacles for fuel cell vehicles, including their high cost and a lack of infrastructure for filling stations. And although hydrogen is abundant on the planet, most of it is captured from fossil fuels, diminishing its potential as a green technology.
Harnessing hydrogen from fresh water is not desirable because it requires tapping into limited resources, and the process requires huge amounts of electricity.
But that may be changing. Researchers from Stanford announced last week that they have devised a way to generate hydrogen from seawater using solar power to separate the hydrogen from oxygen.
They also solved the problem of salt causing corrosion, which has impeded efforts in the past. So the authors say if the so-called hydrogen economy takes off, their new method could increase the availability of fuel cell cars.
The wait may not be long. Bloomberg reports that a Canadian utility has agreed to test a system to extract hydrogen from seawater, and China is massively investing in technology and infrastructure for fuel cell transportation.
And finally, could a bathroom throne have a new noble goal to detect heart failure? It could, because of an innovative toilet seat invented by a team at Rochester Institute of Technology that monitors vital signs for those who have been recently hospitalized for the condition.
Heart failure occurs when not enough blood is pumped to meet the body's needs, but it doesn't mean that the heart has stopped or is about to stop. Rather, it needs support to function properly.
Symptoms of heart failure include shortness of breath, fatigue, and swelling in the ankles, feet, and legs. Therefore, the thighs are a good place to monitor because the body's largest artery runs through them.
The seats, which measure everything from blood pressure to blood oxygen, can detect deteriorating conditions before someone realizes they have a problem. And because the seats transmit data rapidly, interventions can be as simple as a drug change or a short office visit instead of readmission to the hospital, which happens with 25 to 45% of patients.
The inventors are working on FDA approval and hope to make their smart seat available for the nearly 1 million patients diagnosed with heart failure every year. This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Explore new trends in technology at ACE 19, June 9th through 12th in Denver. Learn more at awwaace.org.